tell the average U.S. American poet that language knows more than I do, as Dan Raphael told me via email, and you're likely to upset their apple cart of narcissism. Dan's humility and riotous sense of humor wouldn't allow him to walk too far down that road. You can get that from passages of his which reflect an inner dialogue that would have him avoiding bicycle racers and the temptation to jump into the Willamette Murk and get this decomposing done right. Or how he envisions that he might be the opposite of rain, perhaps wind, except for his smell. To see him read in person, which he's done at venues throughout the Northwest for going on 30 years, is like watching some kind of power plant, though barefoot. And what was overheard at one of his readings may now be legendary. Do you think he's taking acid? Taking it. He wears the patch. Dan Raphael's Impulse and Warp, the Selected 20th Century Poems, is out from Wordcraft of Oregon, his latest book. He performs his work throughout the Northwest, including venues like Bumbershoot, Wordstock, Portland Jazz Festival, Powell's Books, Red Sky Poetry Theater, occasional farmers markets, and other places. Current poems appear in Otoliths, Peaches and Bats, Pemmican, Radioactive Moat, and Heavy Bear. Dan, I'm glad we're getting this done.
Yay.
So,
welcome.
What was that first image of you being exposed to poetry? Do you remember it as a kid?
I remember at maybe my junior year in high school, I had a girlfriend, and I had to take a bus out to where she lived in some strange suburb of Pittsburgh, and that's where the first poem was written, and it immediately seemed kind of magical to me for kind of a blue-collar kid, neither of whose parents graduated from high school, to suddenly be writing poetry, so this must be kind of special, and I should follow up on it.
And this poem was written on the bus, or was it one of those bus poem type things?
Waiting for the bus, anticipating the bus and where the bus would take me type of thing.
So you wrote this poem?
Yes.
Oh, that's what it was.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it was the first one I wrote, you know. And then I had the fortune in high school, this was in the late 60s, so there was a big environmental art exhibit at the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh, and I had some poems blown up onto sheets of styrofoam and posted on the walls there as part of sort of a community arts thing that was good affirmation. Also hung out at a couple coffee houses where they were reading poems by Ginsberg and St. Lawrence and Kerouac and things like that, so was actually performing other people's poems before I was performing my own.
So I'm guessing this is the late 60s, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when you tell the average person the language knows more than I do, you know, that the average poet or the average American poet doesn't want to hear that. But that's something you said to me.
Yeah, and I say it a lot. I mean, I think that's where I come at it from, the power of language that, you know, like I said, why should someone with my background be writing poetry? And I'm just kind of a vessel for language to some extent. It's not automatic writing. I do a lot of crafting. I have worked hard at that. A lot of my editing comes by ear. But it's like a painter saying, I can control light, that I know more than light, that I know more than, or a musician, you know, thinking I can control sound. But poetry has stayed so much further behind, has stayed so tied to the narrative, and part of it is the nature of language. We all talk, anyone can write poetry. Not everyone can sculpt, not everyone can compose music. So it becomes more acceptable. I mean, poetry is almost the most schizophrenic. It's the easiest and I think the most difficult because of that, to just let go to language, and yet you have to keep language intelligible. I mean, we've had people experimenting with just syllables and the visual aspect and the very raw end of language poetry where, you know, throw out syntax altogether. But language without syntax is just sound and isn't really language. So you got to find that point of language being free. Of course, it dredges up. It has to be in the context. Language can't talk. Language can't type, so it needs me or other people like me. So because of that, it has the context that I'm steeped in, which I try to take out. I mean, you know, I'd rather have visions than confession anytime. And So we work it from there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, that comment about acid, I think you printed it in one of your books, mm-hmm. and a classic story. And that's not where it comes from, as far as I know. But your imagination is just absolutely remarkable. Where does stuff come from?
It comes from language. I mean, it's there in the body. I have a somewhat phonographic memory, so I'm hearing things a lot. I read a lot, mostly science fiction and nonfiction. I don't read very much poetry. And so there's a lot of imagination there. Just there's so many words. And again, they get invented. I mean, there's all the terminology of science, all the terminology of food, gardens and plants. There's just so many vocabularies out there to bring in. Sometimes just in terms of their sound and color, but every word reminds you of something, even if you've never heard that word before.
It's interesting, as I'm driving up to your house, on the baseball field was there, and I'm like, oh yeah, he lives across from a baseball field. And then you look out the windows, and it's a tremendous garden. I mean, anywhere you look. And your poetry's a lot like that. It has these I guess, roots in Black Mountain or New York School, like you were telling me via email, but then reaches out and seeking the sun in one way, huh?
Right. It's a wide variety. I mean, different people have tapped into things different ways, from Olson's big study of history, from the Bardic tradition, you know, Ginsberg, Whitman on back. Again, that's when one is overwhelmed by language and is just kind of proclaiming. But just the observation, E. Cummings, A.R. Ammons, people who have done would break the taboos of language, not the taboo of language, the, you know, thou shalt be representational, or thou shalt be trying to recreate an experience. But I want my stuff to be the experience, and what you think of it and what she thinks of it will be different, but as long as you're being stimulated and taken somewhere, what more can you ask for?
The moment of composition is the experience for you when you're writing, is it not?
Yes. Well, it's part of it. I mean, it's the big letting out, and it's just the very high energy part. Then there's reading it over. Boy, my handwriting gets worse and worse, so I think I'm losing poems more now all the time just because I can't read all the words I write in a frenzy. But sometimes, fortunately, the frenzy hits me when I'm at a keyboard. But
what gets cut out when you start cutting things out?
Often indulgences, I think. I can see one, oh, that's clever. I can do two more like that. And you stick with the first one. Or you kind of just get off on a tangent. Sometimes that can end up being a separate poem. But it's just following the energy. Sometimes the poems are written in two or three sessions because A, it got interrupted, or I just got too exhausted and it really didn't get finished. I have had a number of poems written after movies or during other events like concerts or even poetry readings where just, again, not that I'm writing about the media, but because the media, I get into the event, which takes me out of all the crap of daily worries and daily life that keeps the art out, and I can kind of catch some art on the way back after a movie or a reading has taken me.
You're talking about the daily life, that inner dialogue, which, you know, the two references that I mentioned, which are in the poems that you sent, the notion of jumping into the river and letting the decomposing start, get an early start. This is an example of the things that are going through your head, and you're able to remember it when you're back at the desk writing about it. Is it?
Yes. It's just the imagination. Again, there isn't anything that, oh, I'm going to plan this. I mean, you just get, again, there's a spot right on the river walk, the Esplanade, we call it, where there's a sign saying, you know, warning, sewer overflow, don't even think of touching this water. And so that was the spot I had that thought.
So. You know, the interesting thing about great, any kind of great art, but especially great poetry, there's so much in every image and there's so much in every line and every poem that to explain it could take hours. That's obviously why you're right. One question about innovation. Why is it important? You mentioned the fact, and I agree with you completely, that the poets are behind painters and artists and musicians. Why is important for you to try and push the art ahead, to be an innovator? And how do you think...
That's how I write. I haven't had an interesting enough or, brutal enough life to write confessional poems about it, or, interesting all the things I've done type poems. I am not the sit down and spend a half hour every morning like William Stafford writing poems. This is how I work. I try to be open and have respect for people who write more conventionally, thinking that that's their natural voice and it's their steeping to have something all nicely crafted that whoever reads it will know exactly what they mean. But that's them, and so that's just the hand I drew, but I'll play it with gusto.
Yeah. Well, why don't you read the poems?
All right. And we'll start with one you were referring to. Slamming Down, 6:15:10. Rain slamming down like it was March's Pineapple Express or July in a Midwest thunderstorm. Like a vertical train, wide as my vision, sliding into the earth in a billion threads. 3 days ago it was 87, and I got my head pink walking along the river, nimbly avoiding bicycle racers and the temptation to jump into Willamette Murk and get this decomposing done right. We're rich with strawberries, snarping up the last affordable Gulf shrimp, while I read of Gaza, Afghanistan, Republic of Congo, Soweto, the burgeoning consumption in China and India, jungles shaved to fuel the machines that heat the earth, that melt the ice sheets, that flood the cities that Jack built. There's beer and marijuana, self-imposed bans on reading news, frolicking with compost, talking to plants, cats, and friends, getting up when the alarm beeps to maintain this demi-American lifestyle. From a hike in the Columbia Gorge, opposite rain. The opposite of rain, I stride up the hill between the trees, thinking I might be wind, except how I smell among the lens leaves, the transpirational chatter pulling the sky closer with each breath. If I held still long enough, I'd be washed and a couple inches shorter, given new perspective by the soil's constant appetite, unable to translate worm or the elemental phonemes, to merge for one song or break out a new instrument as everyone's costume and body slightly morph. If the clouds were twice as high, what could protect us in a downpour? The mountain's engineers would reorchestrate the wind, as a flagpole doesn't care which anthem is playing, as flakes of my skin evanesce, knowing they may never stop moving, but now have multiple voices. Sometimes the second eye wraps around the head, seeing memory live and transposed, a suit that never fit me before, like I've been a Doug Fir all this time, waiting for the river to inundate me. I have no idea where this one came from. Where my next meal's coming from? I don't know. To melt and catch, to pluck and render. He knew from age 4 that he would be able to fly just by flapping his arms. Pasta shaped like body parts. A fragmented mirror only reflects what's hidden. Please report all electrons to the authorities. The cauliflower wouldn't stop. Remote-controlled seagulls. A hot chestnut held near my throat makes my voice carry 5 times farther. After 300 push-ups, the sand below my hands was beginning to fuse. All guitars start with one string. To sing and fillet, to dress and compromise. I thought under arrest meant free beer. Why is the sun so low, so blue, so square? I'm eating because I haven't for 6 hours, not because I'm hungry. To drill and inspire, to ferret and rearrange. When they get this big, all you can do is walk away. And again. I was at a party and was watching this brightly dressed woman, and so we got the muse of internal weather. The swirling energy inside her clothes, as if her spine extended to the floor, doppelganging leg fork, swaddling maelstrom, corkscrew labia of lapping wave flames, a visible perturbation in her eyes. Two stand-up basses arranging their strings to merge. Forget the tuning. No bows, fingers plucking everywhere, rubbing like drum skins. Sounding notes I still maintain some grip on as they infuse back with what she plays on me. Hands around spine, eyes zipping me open. The language of the lengua. Taste buds pulsing sweet mineral candor. Stepping into the other dimension that's stepping into me. The luminous walls are my lungs, standing entwined as if gravity went elsewhere. Climbing our visions like head first down a complex wall of metamorphic rocks, pressing new buttons to release virtuosities. Fingers with three times as many joints, skin like liquid velvet, bathing in crema. The shrinking together, as if looking through hundreds of vertical blinds, spinning, pulsing from vex to cave, sound emptying room, lung filled with data jungle, as this minute has been so often, from suture to aroma to tone, from accident or implement. Visualizing one card out of how many decks for the colorblind, the gluten-free, thinking mirrors or doorways. Someone will recognize what I'm wearing and take me there. Feed me till I stop erupting. Why am I the only one who can't sleep in the rain? I think a cool thing we like about poetry is when there's just an inspiration, when something just hits you, and sometimes it can be a phrase, and here was just a cold wind. A cold walks into the room. A cold walks into the room, faceless presence, gelatinous adhesion, a coldness, glides, not walks, as if molecules of it were spread all around and began to congregate, maybe just a thread of them, an antenna leading to the full body of coldness, which is also dispersed particles, coldness that doesn't rust or tarnish. To warm is to rust, to glow with oxygen, meaning breath, meaning hunger and movement, toward and away, action without emotion, striking a balance that's aesthetic, rational, as precise as needed, several flowers, but not enough to tell others, cool petals of spring, sun skimming the wall top of interfering silence, gray noise, cloud blindness. In insulating ourselves from winter, we shut out the voices of year-round, when the air is thinner, so the harmony more complex. As if anyone could hold a note for light years of blues, shifting as our trains will never meet. Different propulsions, different struts, frames and load-bearing prisms. When the only gravity is inside our bones, inside whatever we stand on, to not sink into the hungry questions. Not starving, but always willing to pop a few morsels. Never so hungry, doubt demands we go shopping, as if legs to go with, as if close enough to stores when I don't know what state I'm in, while never far from traffic, the momentum of others. A leash so long and flexible you forget it. Collars creating fashion, fashion demanding transparent walls, voyeuristic wind. As birds are their own heat spectrum, their own adamantine range, from bullet hummingbird to boulder gull and crow. The yin and yang, the sea and the prairie, conjoined but not cross-breeding. City gulls so cautious, you wonder if they've ever heard the beach. Even the summer ocean is too cold for our bodies to stay awake in, and we haven't let go enough to fly. So many metals broadcasting so deep in our bones, the coldest hour. Like my spine's a carrot, and the frothy greens of my face are nothing but media. impressions, improvised prayers and pitches, that sweet carrot spine, rooting down just enough to avoid the fury of my crotch, the canyons vulnerable to invasion, a door to a different labyrinth in an abandoned factory flooded with reeds, frogs, and fish, migrating in circles without frustration. A coincident net, following the Escher lines, so we're always right side up but can't know where we'll meet again, mistaking fog and mirrors for companions or newspapers, wishing I had a little door between ribs to slide in rocks, branches, faded packaging, and hear its story, its questions and needs. The braggadocio of confident abandon, made to never come back. Like every day, I'm assigned one box to deliver somewhere in this metropolis. A metropolitan desert or robotized wheat field, where even the supervisor is afraid to be far from the control panel. The wireless can be distracted. Irrigation has a vendetta based on random letters, Scrabble dice with 26 sides. I need a word for what just came into my presence. Might have come out of me, or the reaction of in and external secretions kept separate and airless. Once mixed, you have 30 seconds to get the shape right. The connections and sacrifices, missing corners and forests, or how two broken homes can become a posse of educational potential. So many new things, at least a couple will hook into you, willingly. These dances of less than a square inch, a sustaining memory, like that little bit of basil in the morning egg, sweet garlic toothpaste, olive oil on dry feet. Roll me in flour made of stale bread, green manure, 3 months captured in a kernel, the weight of snow making spring so voracious, almost everything forgets its place, forgets why we built these walls, these databases and procedures, washing our hands every time anyone gets within a yard of us, these furiously mutating bacteria sharing the full spectrum of resistance to everything but their own urges. Soon I'll turn on the heater or go somewhere else. Maybe I'm not really indoors. The cold knows if I think I'm outside, I'll take quick radical action to shut off all access. Thinking I'm upstairs when I'm swimming so close to the surface, the other worms think I'm a heroic fool. Just cause I don't believe in predators won't mean I'm not eaten, gradually, or swallowed whole the moment I was born. Oh, if an avocado is left on the tree too long, it will consume all its flesh till the seed cracks open the skin, falls to the ground, and starts hopping about, stubby wings, crooning for food. Close with this one, and I think the quote came at the time of composition. The quote from, I forget which of Don DeLillo's novels, but I would love the guy. She was doubled over, like there were two of her, the one who'd done the running and the one who didn't know why, swimming in the streets. If the streets had no names, could I get home? If I couldn't count the blocks and curbs sluicing glacial water, downhill ice glistening from 1,000 suns, sun in so many windows, now the curtain's been eaten, pressed between newspapers, soaked from the bottom of waste cans, skin must be peeled, pores rubbed into powder. One of these houses is mine. I walk rumpling like a congeree of abandoned clothes. When the wind whips, when the track disintegrates, all it carried, the driver thought the truck knew where to unload. We couldn't jump that high. My hand won't open like a flower. The vein in the middle, sliding in several needles at once, across a room of shutters and shattered bass, hallways with names. I stand before my reflection does, door made of sky. The house spits me onto the street and folds away like an indecisive newspaper. If thumbs had wings to whistle when nipped, chewing like beavers gazing at the chunky stream, barely lit, refreshingly absent, hands go through like gloves shot from guns. A time few got far, shirts made of someone else's skin, responses to responses, folded into the batter, poured among bricks, straight waves, like escalators on their sides, beached when the city moved. I wanted to be effervescent, but didn't know how to start. I don't want my property to keep going with a wind rising from my feet, simulating readiness. Neither hand knows. Walking backwards, perhaps. Rising from a paved horizon. Stopped by something hard throughout. My practice is never the same. Melting in my hand. Mouthing frostbite. A fly on each side. Odorless traffic. Hands clasped like a bell pepper. That's not rain.
Well, you know, you began and you started with rain references there.
I live in Portland.
That's all that needs to be said.
No more. If it's not raining, it looks like it will.
Well, how else? Obviously, we hear the stories about the Willamette. Thinking that you're going to jump in, and all the plant references, which we can look around your house and see immediate inspiration for that. But how else does the local landscape inform your work? I mean, could you write this kind of stuff in Pittsburgh?
No, I mean, yeah. Mountain references, you have ocean references. I mean, some of my poems I could, because there's an urban aspect to a lot of them too. And so that kind of translatable, I think, no matter where I am. But yeah, having the natural environment, and I think it's just kind of the way the natural world is more part of Portland. A place like Pittsburgh, everything's just a lot older. You know, the sidewalks, the buildings, nature was conquered long ago and has a harder time getting back. Here, you know, we're just starting to pummel nature into subservience. But
you think that's what's happening?
Portland has grown a lot in the 30 years I've been here. You know, I'm sure in all the time you spend in Seattle, you've seen a lot of changes too. So we're still hanging on. We're doing our own part here. Our yard here, thanks to my wife, has over 400 plant varieties, so we're do what you can, where you can, you know, whatever. Someone you can influence.
These plants are your brothers, aren't they?
I think they're my rivals to some extent.
Right. I see. Well, your wife's laughing, so we won't get any further into that one. You know, you mentioned that Pittsburgh's an older city, Chicago, New York, these are all older cities. Their literature traditions are older. You know, they have their heroes in innovative literature. And in Portland, there has been that tradition of innovation, going back to the time that William Carlos Williams read at Reed College, and three students there met him and were inspired by him. Gary Snyder, Lou Welch, Philip Whalen, then right. Leslie Scalapino, also
recently passed,
also a Reed College person. Right. So Portland seems to have its tradition of innovative poetry, more so than Seattle.
Maybe that's just because of Reed College. Maybe Reed College has a tradition and the rest, we just happen to be here around it. But the biggest influence in Portland poetry is like William Stafford, who is, you know, very good writer, but I wouldn't call him innovative, and the kind of cults that go around it, and I think all the problems of any poetry scene. But I think it's a little more wide open, and I think I can somewhat take responsibility for helping to get the different sides together. I did one reading series for 13 years that drew in people from all over the place, and one of my rules was I wouldn't have two people who knew each other reading together. Okay. A, it's just a good, get you more mini audiences to choose from. Everybody brings their friends, and if two people have the same friends, but would also get people hearing other writers that they would might never hear if they just hang around with their compadres. And so I think that's important for any city. I mean, in a way, you can't expect the culture to catch up with you. You have to somewhat make the culture yourself, so it is more like what you want, like a lot of the things you've done, too, with the whole SPLAB and all the, you know, bringing in a sort of line of innovative poetry that was not mainstream to Seattle and the area. So
one of the lines in the poem, in one of the poems you read, I think, really gets to this. You know, we talk about William Stafford. My friend Sam Hamill says poetry is a big house, so there's all kinds of different rooms. And you know, maybe we avoid the Stafford room because we're interested in something that, to quote here, listen, stepping into the other dimension that's stepping into me. So that's stuff that doesn't get into that other dimension. You know, it doesn't interest you. And it's that kind of stuff. You're interested in getting into the other dimensions that maybe you don't even understand.
Well, right. And just finding the doorway and the connection, because I do work in elements of the world around me, but I'll often be juxtaposing things that you never think of putting together. And so there's that. You know, what does the mind do with that when you have two pieces that don't quite fit together, you know? Iron butterfly. I don't know. But, you know, weird combinations that can... All right, because the brain wants to make sense of what it hears or find something to connect it to.
Right.
And so that's why it's good stretching. I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's like Sudokus or crossword puzzles. Again, that's a very good skill, but it's very narrow. And I think to some extent people write poetry like Sudokus instead of Jackson Pollock. I mean,
or instead of wilderness, like we have access here,
right,
more so than they do in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
So there's a wildness here that's obviously reflected in your work. I mean, the natural world is reflected, but more than that, this notion.
It's
that,
there.
Yeah, there's a wildness there. You think people are scared of the wildness? Is that what it is?
I think a lot of people want to have more control over what they're doing in their life, whether it comes from fear or just because that's what they're comfortable with, and they have a value in that, in being able to figure out how to better control things. And I'm just more into the surprise of it, into the, wow, you know, like, just the visions. I mean, like, last week I was walking out of a store appropriately called Limbo, and this young woman goes walking by. I don't know if she was a fairy, an angel, or an elf, but had this ankle-length sea-green cape draped over her and this wavy blonde angel hair about halfway down her back just walking away from me. It was like a vision. And that stuff is out there in the world. And what do you do with that energy of this? I mean, I didn't want to run up to her and see what she really looked like. You know, you want to keep the image and the... I walked out of Limbo and saw an angel. I mean,
yeah.
Or something.
And those kind of people you're going to find more often in Portland than in the average city. I mean,
this was close to Reed College. We'll blame it all on
that. I saw the bumper sticker on the way here, "Keep Portland Weird," and it was upside down. So,
no, it wasn't.
You know, the interesting thing, to keep things weird and to have a political commitment is a very difficult task, and you've accomplished that to some degree. How important is that for you to have a political well, it's part of you, so it's a reflection.
Well, it's part of it, and again, just like I don't do other things in my poetry overtly, I mean, I do occasionally do some more overt political stuff, and I'm not really sure those are poems or they're just rants, you know, however you want to classify it. But I think it's more that encouraging vision, encouraging not accepting this is that, and you should see it that way and no other way. Just to look at it from different points of view, to put that with this, and then, oh, you know, that informs both of them and switches things around. So that's important, knowing the reality of the problems that are facing us. I mean, we're world's in serious trouble, both ecologically and economically. I did have a fun thing last fall. I kind of helped organize a big event called the E-Convergence, where we got a number of... our two keynote speakers were Noam Chomsky and Derek Jensen, the radical ecologist. And so those were kind of... And we had like about 60 workshops and all this other stuff, and I just signed on as an organizer, not having as much political cred as most of the other people, but I had a good time, and I was on the executive board and all this sort of stuff. So sometimes you can just be in the right place to make an impact and help things along and help pass on information to other people.
Well, I'm glad you're in this place. Right. Thanks for being part of this.
Hey, thanks for coming, Paul.